Good afternoon and welcome to the EcoNews Report, a production of the North Coast Environmental Center in conjunction with KHSU, located on the campus of Humboldt State University. I am Raina Nanayel, your host for the EcoNews Report. I am the Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center, and we are very pleased to have as our guest today Tom Schlosser. He is an attorney and environmentalist who has worked with the Hoopa Tribe for over 30 years. He'll be speaking with us today about the recent draft EIS and EIR that have been released on the Klamath Settlement Agreements. Thank you so very much for being with us today, Tom.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Great. So the draft EIS and EIR, which is Environmental Impact Statement and Environmental Impact Report, they've recently been released on the Klamath Settlement Agreements. And I know that you have worked with the tribes on the legal and environmental issues surrounding the proposed dam removal and restoration for a great number of years. What is your reaction to the EIS and EIR?
Well, they're gigantic. These are Recovery Act funds at work. I mean, the paper copy's in two binders about 8 inches high. So it's pretty formidable if you're going to actually read the paper copy. But it's available digitally on the klamathrestoration.gov website. And when you pull it up in PDF and start running word searches, it's manageable.
So that's how you recommend that people tackle it, kind of, is by looking at keywords and trying to find the real meat of it.
I think that's right. I mean, of course, it depends on your interests. You'll find that the draft EIS is very focused on dam removal and doesn't say enough about the Klamath Basin Restoration Act, the KBRA. So there's not enough about the power subsidies for irrigation pumping or some of the other problematic parts of the KBRA.
The KHSA is a negotiated settlement in lieu of following the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission relicensing process for the Klamath Hydroelectric Project. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about the KHSA and the KBRA to give people a little background?
Well, sure. These are two completely separate processes. You know, Pacific Corp, a Warren Buffett company, has had a license to operate the Klamath Hydro dams for a number of years, and the last license was issued in 1956. So we've known that it was going to expire at the beginning of 2006 for a long time. Meanwhile, problems in the Upper Klamath Basin, that problem's been festering for a long time. What happened in the Bush administration was these two things were tied together, and it's a very unhappy marriage. So the Klamath Basin water rights adjudication, which has been going on before the Oregon Department of Water Resources for many years, is still sort of grinding along, and they're trying to figure out water rights in the upper basin. And the biological opinions still apply to try to protect some of the threatened and endangered species in the basin. But these things were connected to the FERC relicensing process, and I think the result is a terrible mess.
And I understand it that the KBRA was actually crafted after Pacific Corp dropped out of talks in mid-2006. Is that correct?
Mostly right. I mean, I think that, as I said, that the hydro project relicensing work had been going on for a long time. And then at a point, Pacific Corp either dropped out or was asked to leave so that the Interior Department could kind of force the parties to try to work out what became the KBRA. Then when the KBRA was mostly in place, the administration negotiated the predecessor to the KHSA, which was a document released just after the elections in 2008 called the Agreement in Principle. So in the relicensing proceedings, Pacific Corp had essentially lost its efforts to protect this outmoded hydro project by challenging the terms and conditions which were imposed on the new license. And that was all litigated, and they lost in 2006. That was the point at which dam removal, if carried out under the normal way, under the FERC process, could have happened. But that's kind of been hijacked, as I say.
So let's talk just briefly about a normal dam removal process. And can I get your concerns about the settlement agreements, the draft EIS, EIR, with relation to this? For example, why the KHSA and the KBRA are kind of wedded and what the problems with that are?
Well, I think they stem from a misunderstanding, and it was an intentional misunderstanding, that there was a need for legislation to achieve dam removal. You know, the way the Federal Power Act works is that private companies get licenses to use public waterways and obstruct navigation for a specific period of time. And then when the license expires, if they want a new license, they have to comply with the law as it then exists. So when you think back to PacifiCorp's license having been issued in 1956, that was long before NEPA, you know, the National Environmental Policy Act, or the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, or the Clean Water Act. All of those acts came later. So when the license expired, they were facing having to comply with those acts. But it was clear that they were going to have to provide upstream and downstream fish passage. It's perfectly possible, but for these ancient structures, it's cost prohibitive. So ordinarily, when the new license issued requiring them to upgrade the project, PacifiCorp would have said, no, we won't agree to that license, we can't do that economically, and so we'll remove it instead. That's the normal process.
But then we got this Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement tied to this. Can you talk about how politically and regionally how they came to be tied together?
Well, as I mentioned, the upper basin conflicts over water have been longstanding. And years ago, in the 1980s, the federal courts ruled that the Klamath tribe had reserved water rights in the former Klamath Reservation area. So the Oregon Department has been conducting this water right adjudication to sort out who gets which rights. The Klamath Reservation, you know, was created in 1864, so it was created long before the federal irrigation project up there. But the project and the off-project irrigators have come to rely on water and some other things. So the Bureau of Reclamation wanted very much to protect the farming interests. You know, they're kind of their constituents. And that coincided with a very evenly divided U.S. Senate and an effort by the Bush administration to sway the election, which they were able to do. In 2002, Gordon Smith was elected, a Republican, and then in 2008, he lost and he went back to the Democrats. So it's a very evenly divided state, and so that, I think, had a lot to do with the administration's effort to kind of tie these two things together, because I think they knew that for lower basin advocates, for fisheries advocates, people who care about clean water and so on, dam removal is a really important objective, a really desirable thing. And so that's the little bit of sugar that they hope makes the medicine go down. But the medicine's pretty deadly.
But we should really emphasize that the U.S. government has trust responsibility with regard to tribal water and fishing rights for the tribes. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. There's a long history to the federal court rulings about federal trust responsibilities. But, you know, just think about it in general terms, that treaties with Indian tribes and statutes enacted by the U.S. over the years have made the U.S. a trustee for Indian property rights. So there's lots of tribal property that can't be sold at all without congressional approval, and lots of transactions with tribes that can't go forward without federal approval. So the federal government kind of has taken on a guardianship role, as they say, or has become a trustee of certain property. And that principle has been applied specifically to water rights in the Klamath Basin, as well as to fishing rights of the Hoopa and Yurok tribes. So with respect to water rights, for example, there are opinions of the solicitor talking about the Bureau of Reclamation's obligation to avoid interfering with reserved tribal water and fishing rights in its management of the Klamath Irrigation Project. And so you say, well, what is it they're trying to avoid interfering with? Well, at the time the reservations were established, which is 1855 in the case of Yurok and 1864 for Hoopa and Klamath, the reservations were established to provide homelands for those Indian people and to allow them to continue to make a moderate living based on taking fish. And their cultures are completely tied up with fishing and salmon. These are critical in all kinds of senses. So it was protection of those resources that the Bureau of Reclamation and other federal agencies have a trust obligation to protect.
How is it possible that the Klamath Irrigation Project receives 335,000 to 385,000 acre feet per year before the first-in-time water rights of the tribes under the settlement agreement?
Well, it won't be possible unless Congress permits it. And that's why it's so tragic that dam removal is being connected to legislation that would override these trust obligations. Now, for some of the tribes, I mean, there are tribes who've supported the KBRA, and of course, they're free to agree to that. But three of the tribes in the basin have not agreed to that, and their rights would be overruled, if Congress allows it.
What are some of the major problems in your long history of working with these issues that you've isolated, and what are the alternatives? And clearly, overriding other tribes' right to their water rights and fishing rights is a major issue.
Well, it is a very major issue. Let me first touch on the KHSA. The problem with the KHSA, the hydro agreement, is first that it's connected to the KBRA. Second, that it requires legislation, which wouldn't ordinarily be required. And the legislation that satisfies the KHSA and the legislation, thus, that's necessary for the Secretary to make an affirmative decision on dam removal is legislation that carries out the KBRA. Well, then you look at the KBRA. First of all, there's no guarantee of water for fish. None. Because what's guaranteed is the amount that can be diverted by the Klamath Project and the other upper basin users. And so fish get what's left over. Second, there aren't any restoration goals in the Klamath Basin Agreement, so you can't tell whether restoration has succeeded or not. There's no numerical objective. What's the target? It's not stated. The KBRA requires the tribes to waive their claims of violation of trust, water, and fishing rights, as I've been mentioning. The KBRA is looking for about $1 billion in federal money. Now, those estimates have been scaled down in some of the secret meetings held by the KBRA parties. Now, they're down to $800 million over the next 15 years. But this is a particularly bad time to be looking for $1 billion from Congress, so that's an obstacle to passage. And one of the things that bothers me the most about the KBRA is the agreement of the parties to support changing the biological opinion so that they would have approval for these water diversions. Well, never mind what the fish need. It's just people getting together and saying, NIMS, you got to issue a biological opinion that applies. And you might say, well, Tom, you know, why should you worry about that? Well, I worry about that because of the events of 2002. But we've seen biological opinions manipulated for political purposes before. So that's just the top few of the problems with these agreements.
And you mentioned the amount of money that it's going to require the federal government and or the states to come up with for this restoration. I was just going to ask you broadly, who's paying for this project and why doesn't PacifiCorps have an obligation to pay for dam removal and restoration of the Klamath watershed since it's received profit associated with revenues for so many years of hydroelectric power?
Well, I agree with your question. Why indeed aren't they responsible for paying for the cost of dam removal? But let me take it one part at a time. First, deal with the KHSA. $200 million will come from electric ratepayers, who, of course, have gotten the benefit of this cheap power. That's a cap, though. And so in the press this week, there's been lots of happy stuff about how the total cost will only be $290 million, which might turn out to be true. But that would mean that $90 million of it would come from a California water bond. Now, as you know, the California water bond is a big package which was taken off the ballot by the governor's office last time. It's not scheduled to go on the ballot this year. But, you know, why should California taxpayers get stuck with the cost of that? Why shouldn't the costs of removal be placed on the shareholders and the other beneficiaries of this? Now, let's turn to the KBRA. That's where the $1 billion comes in. And the $1 billion of the KBRA doesn't go to dam removal at all. It goes to a lot of other things, including big subsidies to irrigation power. And I could say more about that. There was an interesting study done by Oregon State University, a Professor Jagger there, who's one of the agricultural economists, talking about the low power rates that the Klamath Irrigation Project and some of the off-project irrigators enjoyed for a long time, and talking about what would happen if they had to pay the same rates that other irrigators in California and Oregon have to pay. And the result would be that they would use less water if they had to pay market rates. So water savings could be achieved, but that isn't what the KBRA does. Instead, the KBRA subsidizes that cheap power for pumping, which exacerbates the problem. There's a long list, kind of a Christmas tree, of ornaments in the expenditures under the KBRA. There's about $100 million for the water plan prepared by the Klamath Irrigation District folks, which I think is going to be a plan for how to shift their pumping to groundwater instead of using surface water.
I'm speaking with Tom Schlosser, environmental attorney for the Hoopa tribe, talking about issues related to the Klamath draft EIR and EIS. So we also have another issue that is connected to this, and that's about Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. And I know that there has been a lack of compliance to the Clean Water Act on the Klamath since the hydroelectric agreement expired. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, sure. Section 401 was added to the Clean Water Act in 1972, and it gives states a role so that a federal license can't be issued unless the applicant for the license shows that he or she has complied with state water quality standards. And in decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, it's been established that water quality includes water quantity. So, for example, in the Jefferson County PUD case up here involving the Dozie Wallops River, where Washington State had a really high standard for water quality, which included minimum in-stream flows, that condition could be imposed on the hydro applicant, and the hydro applicant then couldn't build an economically feasible project because they had to comply with state water quality standards. Well, so here, when PacifiCorps' license expired in 2006, they applied for a Section 401 permit for the relicensed project. Well, under California state law, the State Water Resources Control Board handles that, and they have to comply with CEQA when they issue a 401 cert, we call it. So they dickered with PacifiCorps for nearly 2 years, trying to figure out who was going to pay for the preparation of the CEQA EIR. And then PacifiCorps worked out this agreement in principle that I mentioned and asked the Water Board to stop work on the 401, which they readily did. So in this 3 years since the first abeyance, the State Water Board has repeatedly refused to process PacifiCorps' application and has always granted the requests of PacifiCorps to just take no action on it. And because the FERC license can't issue without a Section 401 permit, FERC, in theory, can't do anything. Well, it's not quite that bad. This doesn't really get FERC off the hook because FERC has the authority to rule that the state has waived the right to require a Section 401 permit. And I hope that FERC will do that. But as we speak today, you have both FERC and the state permitting agencies refusing to carry out their lawful authorities, I mean, let alone their trust obligations to tribal fisheries. It's their public interest under their existing law. They're just not doing anything.
And one of the problems with that is just that we have serious and severe water quality issues in the Upper Klamath Basin and in, you know, depending when, in sections of the Trinity as well. So this is an issue because we've got endangered species that are being impacted while the deal is being negotiated. And it's also an issue just because of compliance. What are we risking here, and including impacts on people in the area? What are we risking with these water quality issues?
Well, what we're doing is postponing the application of the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. We're not doing cleanup that we could and should do. And so, you know, the Klamath Basin has always had a lot of nutrients in it. It was a marshy area even before the hydrology got messed up by people coming into the area at the beginning of the 20th century. And that problem is made much worse by the use of fertilizers and pesticides around Upper Klamath Lake, especially in the Klamath Irrigation Project. And that runoff from the agricultural fields gets pumped back into the Klamath River through the Straits Drain. Well, the Bureau of Reclamation, which owns the Straits Drain, has been fighting any kind of permitting or water quality standards for what they pour into the river there. And what they pour into the river is very high in nitrates. It's practically ammonia. So you have all of these nutrients coming into the river, and you have the existing Copco and Iron Gate reservoirs, which are fairly deep, and they're these toxic brews. And so you should see the pictures. I mean, it looks like split pea soup in the summertime. It really does. It's just bright green, and that's hazardous to mammals. It's fatal to livestock and pets and so on. It's hazardous to people, and it's hazardous to fish. So there's an urgent need to clean these things up, and it's just tragic that this isn't happening.
And again, we're talking about areas of impact, including Upper Klamath Lake, Tule Lake, and the Lost River, and what the settlement deal means for these ecosystems that are so important to the entire Klamath watershed. A lot of emphasis has been put on the dams and the dam removal, or the dams as being the reason for the nutrient loading. But you're pointing out to us that it's agricultural inputs, it's lack of proper flow regimes, and various other things, correct?
Well, that's right. The KBRA, I think, leaves Tule Lake out of the picture completely. And one of the reasons why the KBRA doesn't achieve water quality improvements is because it's built on an agreement to continue commercial farming of the wildlife refuges. Now, that's a practice that should never have started and ought to be stopped, but there is a provision in the KBRA to continue that. And so rather than restoring the natural wetlands and the marshy areas that would have cleaning effects on water, the KBRA preserves the diked and drained features of a lot of the Upper Klamath Basin.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people, I mean, Pat Higgins and those folks have done a great deal of work on water quality problems. It's just plain that water quality problems are not going to be resolved by these agreements, even if somebody comes up with $1 billion.
And I'd like to remind the listeners that almost everybody that I talk to is for dam removal, but the issues that are really troubling the environmental groups and troubling a lot of the biologists and fisheries biologists is that we have suckers that are protected under the Endangered Species Act. We have coho. We've got tribes' water and fisheries rights at stake here, and these issues seem not to be addressed under the settlement agreement. Again, you pointed out that agricultural irrigation waters are preempting tribal rights. You pointed out that in-stream flows for fisheries and for endangered species are not being necessarily accounted for. And again, the nutrient loading that's happening because of agricultural fertilizers. I might also remind the listeners that given that California has lost about 90% of its wetlands, plus more than that, really, over the years of development, why would we not restore the Tule Lake area?
Well, it makes no sense to me, I'll tell you. And my understanding is that even if all of the restoration measures of the KBRA were funded and carried out, we would still have a situation in the area where the Straits Drain dumps into Keno Reservoir that fish can't pass through, that much of the year that is absolutely fatal to fish. And so we're not going to be able to restore migrating fish above that point without doing something about water quality conditions in the upper basin.
And the suckers are also a food source for Native Americans, and I know that they don't get a lot of play, as much play as salmon, because, you know, they're maybe not as charismatic as salmon, but they are a very important species and a very endangered species in this region. How do upper basin activities relate to toxic microcystine algae blooms? Just to get people to understand that this is somewhat of a natural process, but it's being exacerbated. So we talked about the toxic algae. We talked a little bit about the water quality issues. Can you just wrap that up for us a little bit?
Well, the problems with livestock getting into the water and problems of overuse of fertilizer really contribute to algae conditions in the upper basin. And so there's a real need to protect watersheds from these kinds of contaminants. And my understanding is that the history of algae in the upper basin doesn't really include the toxic algae or a relatively recent phenomenon. How exactly they've come to be such a widespread problem, I'm not sure, but it's certainly because of human-caused activities in the upper basin.
So we also have some other issues. There is this movement to supplement with groundwater surface flows. Why is that a dangerous approach for the hydrologic management in the region?
You know, perhaps you've seen the pictures of ground subsidence down in the California Central Valley, where in places the ground has gone down 15 or 20 feet from pumping out of groundwater. You know, groundwater is a resource and it can be mined, but it's replenished, if at all, very slowly. In some cases, the groundwater that's removed is thousands of years old. So there are measures relating to groundwater in the KBRA, and specifically the U.S. Geological Survey, the USGS, which is a very great agency within Interior, has done some research on groundwater in the upper basin. So the KBRA includes a trigger level of 6% impact. That is, there's an adverse effect on surface water. If groundwater flows at certain springs, there are 10, I think, listed in the KBRA, are reduced by 6%. But the practical problem, I mean, that may be the scientific answer, that a 6% reduction shows that surface water is going to be adversely affected. But how do you show that that 6% reduction is due to pumping by the irrigation project as opposed to, you know, a couple of dry years in a row? It's a very difficult proof problem. So I have a lot of respect for the USGS, but I think the management of that kind of standard is just not going to be practical.
Not only is groundwater important for maintaining the structure of our aquifers and the structure of our land, the structure of our seeps and springs, but it's also responsible for providing us with the kind of temperatures, the cold temperatures that are salmon loving. Without the process of groundwater infiltration, we're often not seeing the kinds of temperatures that we need in our rivers. So it's a very complex hydrologic system between surface flows, groundwater infiltration, and in-stream flows. And I just wanted to lay the groundwork for why it's puzzling for people, because it's, you know, water that's not seen. And it's like, you know, wells, we've been dealing with wells for going back forever. And I think a lot of folks don't really understand how important it is for what we're seeing in our streams and watersheds. Can you leave us with an overview of what is right and what is wrong with the settlement agreements with regard to public trust doctrine and protection of native fishing and water rights?
Well, I'm sad to say that I think that the public interest, as well as trust responsibility to tribes, has been stolen by the Bureau of Reclamation and Pacific Corps here. You know, dam removal clearly is in the interest of the basin, but it's attached to so many adverse consequences under this pair of linked agreements that I think it's not going to happen. This planning process that we call the KHSA is not a dam removal agreement. It's just an agreement to make certain decisions at certain times. And we're coming up to another deadline in the KHSA is March 31st of next year. Well, in order for the Secretary to do the right thing and proceed with dam removal, you would have to have federal legislation appropriating the money and authorizing the taking of tribal water rights and so on. And that legislation just isn't likely to get passed. So there's got to be a way to get FERC to do its job on relicensing, to get the State Water Board to stop blocking action with its Section 401 permit, and get this process back to the agency that could produce dam removal without giving away the water rights and fishing opportunities of the Klamath Basin.
And that would be the Federal Energy and Regulatory Commission, FERC.
Yes. Yes.
And that's the alternative that we're talking about. So when you hear environmentalists criticizing the KBRA or the KHSA, it's not that they don't want to see dam removal. It's that they don't believe that dam removal should come at the expense of tribal fishing and water rights or ESA or Clean Water Act. And that is what many of the people are putting forward. Thank you so much for all this. I'd like to remind everybody that an association of groups will be holding a Klamath workshop on October 19th at the Warfinger Building from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Patrick Higgins, the Sierra Club, has funded this for us in large part. The Audubon Society, the North Coast Environmental Center, and EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center, will all be coming together to just provide information and guidance on this very complex issue. Because it has been going on for so long. There are so many different regulatory processes involved and so many competing issues, environmental issues, fisheries issues, tribal issues, farmer-related issues, irrigation and water district issues. So thank you so much. I know that you have been pivotal in much of this research, and I want to thank you. I'm honored that you joined us today.
Well, my privilege. I enjoyed it, and I just want to point out that I've recently published an article on the two agreements in the Washington Journal of Environmental Law and Policy. It's called Dewatering Trust Responsibility, and I think that would be useful to many of your listeners.
So, thank you, Tom.
Okay, my pleasure. Good talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye.
This has been the Eco News Report, and my name is Raina Nanael, and I've been your host for the past half hour. I was speaking with Tom Schlosser, tribal attorney with the Hoopa Tribe for the past 30 years. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again at KHSU website under archive programs at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced for KHSU, located at Humboldt State University, in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Thanks to our engineer, Fred McLaughlin. Please join us again next Thursday at 1:30 p.m. here on KHSU for the Eco News Report.